Would you want to be on a panel that decides who wins some kind of literary award? It doesn't have to be books, movies, TV shows. Would you want to be on some kind of like small council of people who decides who wins an award?
No.
Not at all?
I would give everybody the award.
Okay. What if you were like an Emmy voter, an Oscar voter?
Yeah, I would do that.
I would do that too. Especially because I think that... Because
then I'd get the free screeners.
You get the free screeners, which is very difficult now, finding all of these movies streaming and streaming before the Oscars. Mm-hmm. Like, we're still waiting on... Some of the things just came. Like, this just came to, like, buying VOD. Poor Things, I think, and The Zone of Interest, which are the two we have left.
Mm-hmm.
And these movies are tough to find.
Yeah, they are. I don't do it. You do
it. I mean, not find, but, you know, to buy or rent or stream somewhere.
Mm-hmm.
This year hasn't been terrible with some of the other awards, because like Rustin's on Netflix, Naiad's on Netflix, but like the Best Picture nominees, a lot of them have been a little difficult. And I would like those screeners. And also, I think that a lot of members of the Academy don't watch all the movies.
That's probably true.
The problem would be we would have to watch all the other ones that we don't watch, like the shorts and the stuff like that, which I watched a couple of years of, and man, those are rough sometimes.
Yeah, but I would take my job seriously.
Oh, absolutely.
So I would do that. I would not be on a 5-person panel to decide who wins an award.
Who wins, like, the National Book Award.
No.
Yeah, no, I think that we could. We should be Oscar voters, I think.
I think so. Why not? Speak for the people.
Yes.
Okay, and we're back with another movie for Oscar season.
And also norovirus.
We have something like every other week.
Yep.
So, you know, the throwing up is done.
Yes.
So that's good.
I didn't at all.
Lucky you. And so we're here. We're recording. I'm Erin.
I'm Tom.
And this is Baby's First Watch List, the podcast watching lots of movies this award season. We watched about half of Rustin.
We did.
But then you fell asleep because you have the neurovirus.
Yes, because I had neurovirus.
Today's episode is all about the 2023 comedy drama written and directed by first-time director of a feature film, Cord Jefferson. And it's called American Fiction.
It is.
Jefferson actually won an Emmy for writing for Watchmen a couple years ago, which was a really good show.
Do you remember which episode he wrote for?
I looked it up. They all kind of blend for me. It was one that kind of went back and forth with the time.
Was it the Dr. Manhattan episode?
Maybe.
Let me see which one it was.
I don't remember. He also previously wrote for The Good Place, Master of None, and The Nightly Show with Larry Wilmore. He also wrote for Station 11, which I still have to see.
Yeah.
And he was actually a consultant for Succession.
Oh, really?
Mm-hmm. Which is interesting. So this movie was based on the novel Erasure by Percival Everett, which was published in 2001, which was a long time ago when you think about an adaptation like that. That's not like, oh, it's a classic.
Right.
Like it's, oh, we're adapting Great Expectations or whatever. And it's interesting because it seemed like it was very timely then, and now it doesn't feel very super dated. You know, it's something that they were able to kind of adapt for 20 years later. Interestingly, the novel that Monk writes is written within the novel. So like,
I did read that.
The book that started off as My Pathology.
Yes.
And turned into something else.
We will not be
naming the actual title that it ended up being.
Yes.
Was in the book, which is kind of interesting. So you could read what he wrote. So it kind of contributed to a very meta and experimental narrative, which is in part mimicked in the movie.
Yes.
It's definitely very meta by the end.
One of the more memorable scenes, too, with Keith David and the guy who originated the James Madison role in Hamilton.
Yes.
And Hercules Mulligan.
Also, interesting to probably nobody but me and maybe you, Percival Everett's wife, Danzy Senna, she is an author. And so she wrote a book, Caucasia, that I read in college.
Cool.
So there you go. Because I had never read any of his books, but I did read one of hers in my, I believe it was my Epiphanal Blackness class, which was one of my capstones. The music was by Laura Cartman. She's known for composing music for the EverQuest video game series. Do you know what that is?
I think I've heard the name, but no.
She also has a lot of Emmy nominations for shows like Why We Hate, Lovecraft Country, and Miss Marvel.
Cool.
And so there's a whole Wikipedia page about her creating the music for this movie.
Yeah.
Which was nominated for an Oscar.
No, it was on the shortlist.
I thought it was nominated.
Mm.
Am I crazy?
I don't know if it was nominated.
Original score? I put
Maybe
it.
Maybe it was.
I wrote original score nomination.
Let's go with yes. I thought it was on the shortlist.
It was on the shortlist, but then it got on the really
shortlist.
Yeah,
you're right. You're right. Okay, you're right.
Good. And so she really emphasized the jazz aspect of the score and how she connected to that. American Fiction stars Jeffrey Wright, who's an acclaimed character actor who is actually less of a character actor than you think he is.
Yes.
So he actually won a Tony Award for Angels in America back in 1993.
But he's also younger than you think he is, even though he won a Tony in 1993 and was in Basquiat in what, like 95?
96, something like that. He won an Emmy for reprising that role on TV in a TV miniseries 10 years later. So it was back in 2003. So he's been winning biggies.
That was an Emmy?
Yeah.
Does he have a Grammy?
I don't know. I don't think he has a Grammy.
It would be crazy if he was an EGOT winner.
I don't think so. He's been in so much stuff, starting with a lead role in the movie Basquiat in the mid-90s, and including things like he's in a couple of the James Bond movies. He plays a role in the Hunger Games series.
One of the mains in Westworld.
Yeah, he was in The Batman, Boardwalk Empire, and Westworld.
I saw somebody online the other day talk about how he's the perfect Commissioner Gordon in Batman, because Commissioner Gordon has to be somebody who, like, recognition-wise, can go toe-to-toe with Batman, but also, like, is, like, reserved and can fade into the background enough where, like, Gary Oldman now is probably too big for that.
Yeah.
But Jeffrey Wright is perfect for that.
Yeah. He's so good. The movie also stars Tracee Ellis Ross, best known for Girlfriends and then Blackish. She's a big TV actress. Issa Rae, known for Insecure and President Barbie. She's President Barbie and Barbie. Yeah. Sterling K. Brown, who also is a big TV actor for This Is Us. He also was in, he played Chris Darden in the American Crime Story O.J. Simpson series, which he was excellent in that. And Leslie Uggams, who's a Tony Award winner, who also was in the Roots miniseries back in the day.
Oh, wow. I didn't know that.
And I think she was Emmy nominated for that, actually. That was nominated, I believe, for like 37 Emmys.
Which kind of adds another like little layer into this movie.
And she also is in the Deadpool series. She plays the Wade.
Deadpool's like roommate.
Roommate, yeah. So this 117-minute movie was filmed in late 2022. It premiered at the Toronto International Film Festival. It actually won the People's Choice Award there. Upon its release, it made $20.7 million on a budget that was sub $10 million, which is pretty good for this big cast, a really well-known cast. It's a critical success, currently holding a 94% on Rotten Tomatoes. And there's not much about the background of the production and stuff because it's too new. But it has been nominated for 5 Oscars: Best Picture, Actor, Supporting Actor, Adapted Screenplay, and Original Score. It recently won the BAFTA for Adapted Screenplay, which was the only award that it was nominated for at that ceremony.
Which is interesting given that it didn't get the other nominations, but it did win the one pretty big award that it was up for.
I'm marking that down as a possibility then on my Oscars bracket.
I would say it's at this point, Adapted Screenplay is like, it's going to be one of this Oppenheimer and Barbie.
Yeah. I could see it going to American Fiction.
Interesting to see where it'll go.
Yeah. So New Jersey connections were few and far between here.
Well, there's a lot of New York.
A lot of New York
in this movie.
But okay, so Leslie Uggams was in Roots.
Yes.
Alex Haley.
Are you going where I think you are?
Alex Haley, who wrote Roots, he did a lot of research.
He did.
For the book at Princeton University.
Yes.
And so that.
And who did he do research with?
I'm not going to bring the fact that my great grandma was a librarian assistant lady. She probably said hi to him.
I know. I like showed him where a book was.
And I don't even think she would be doing that. I literally think she would be like, hi, checking in. But yeah, that's a little connection there, which is fun. And then Erica Alexander, who plays Coraline, she, which is Monk's kind of love interest girlfriend, in the movie, yeah. girlfriend in the movie. She's from The Cosby Show, Living Single, a whole bunch of stuff.
Yeah.
She actually grew up in Philly, which I count as New Jersey.
Yeah, Philly is New Jersey.
New Jersey, but like
the fun parts of Philly.
Yeah.
Or New Jersey.
Yeah. Well, we're just so close to there
yeah.
that it's, you know, close enough.
As we've said many times, Philly to where we are is closer than North Jersey, so.
Yes. Yeah, we're like half an hour from Philly if you yeah. drive really fast.
Yeah.
And there's, you know, no problems with that bridge that collapsed.
And no traffic. Yeah, yeah. The bridge collapse, yeah.
We fixed that in 6 days.
Really quick.
So, not bad. Josh Shapiro, good job. So, honestly, like, that's all I have for my background for American Fiction. I like I said, it's a new movie. So, there's not a ton of, like, you know, production stuff or... fun fact. I mean, you do the fun facts.
I have a few trivias later.
Yeah.
Nothing like, I mean, it's not like when I was going through all that jazz and there was like 1,000 different things.
Right, exactly.
But, yeah.
So, yeah.
I could do the plot summary.
Perfect.
All right. Thelonious Monk Ellison, played by Jeffrey Wright, is a highly intelligent black upper-class writer and professor in Los Angeles. His novels receive academic praise but sell poorly, and publishers reject his latest manuscript for not being black enough. He's placed on a temporary leave due to his brashness with his students. He goes to a seminar. His panel is poorly attended, but there's a packed room for an interview with Centaurra Golden, whose best-selling novel, We's Lives in the Ghetto, panders to black stereotypes. In Boston, Monk bonds with his mother, Agnes, played by Leslie Uggams. Leslie?
Yeah.
Who shows signs of Alzheimer's disease, and sister, Lisa, played by Tracy Ellis Ross, who's a doctor. While having drinks with Monk, Lisa suffers a heart attack and later dies in the hospital.
Yeah, that was crazy.
Tracy Ellis Ross got the hook early in this movie.
She did.
It's a shame because she was great in her little few scenes.
Yeah.
While Monk's estranged brother, Cliff, played by Sterling K. Brown, attends Lisa's funeral. He is divorced after his wife caught him cheating with a man, and he's now kind of in a spiral after that. Monk meets and starts dating Coraline, a lawyer living across the street. Frustrated by Centaurra's success and the cost of care for his mother, Monk writes a book called My Pathology under the pseudonym Stag R. Lee, and it's a satirical novel mocking the literary cliches expected from black writers. He submits it to publishers as a joke, but of course he gets a massive advance for the book, and as Stag, which is his sort of persona as a former convict and current fugitive, he gets offered a movie deal from Wiley, played by Adam Brody, who is a movie producer. He eventually tries to sabotage the deal by changing the name of the book to literally just the F word.
Yes.
But the executives agree, to his surprise. While judging a literary award contest, quote, as part of a diversity push, he finds that Centaurra is on the committee as well, and he is surprised to learn she shares some of his views. F, of course, becomes a bestseller, though Coraline, Cliff, and the public remain unaware that Stag is Monk, and the FBI contacts the publisher. At the wedding reception of the family housekeeper, Lorraine, Monk and Cliff discuss the impact of their father's suicide, and Cliff encourages Monk to let people love all of him, like Cliff is trying to do with his, you know, sexual identity. Mm-hmm. F is submitted for the literary award, and the white judges rave, though Centaurra calls it pandering. Centaurra and Monk eventually argue about Centaurra's book and whether she is partially responsible for white readers forming stereotypes. Later, Monk finds that Coraline enjoyed reading F. They argue and break up. At the awards ceremony, F is, of course, announced as the winner. When Monk goes on stage and says he has a confession to make, the screen cuts to black, and the story is revealed to be Monk's screenplay to Wiley as an alternative to the F film adaptation. Wiley likes the screenplay but asks for a different ending, so after going through a couple more, Monk ends up suggesting one where police, believing Monk to be a fugitive holding a gun, shoot him at the ceremony. Much to Monk's dismay, Wiley loves it, and the film moves into production. As Monk and Cliff drive off from the studio, Monk and one of Wiley's actors playing a slave acknowledge each other. Mm-hmm. American Fiction.
Yep. Good movie.
It is really good.
I liked it a lot.
It's smart.
Yeah, it's very smart.
Like, the dialogue is quick and witty and snappy.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, it has a clear viewpoint and things it needs to say.
And the performances are so good.
Yeah, I mean, the cast is unbelievable.
So good. Oh, like, everybody.
There's not a weak point in the cast at all.
No. No, exactly. So, let's see here. Let's start with the movie. What is the strongest aspect of this movie, and what is your least favorite part about it or thing about it?
This sort of runs into one of my questions, but the strongest part of this movie, I think, is Jeffrey Wright.
Yeah.
Because Monk is so annoying.
Yeah.
He's so pompous. He's just like, he's insufferable in a lot of this movie. But Jeffrey Wright is so good at injecting sort of like, you look at Jeffrey Wright and you're like, that guy's a good dude.
Mm-hmm.
Like,
right.
He's so good at drawing that out of his characters. And it's not to say that Monk is a bad guy. The character on paper is a bad guy. He's not a bad guy. These are all just layers of defense.
Mm-hmm.
And it takes something, it takes a performance like Wright and like those around him. Like, it takes Tracy Ellis Ross being like, you know, like telling him stuff about how he used to be and how their dad used to be and kind of like their little jokey interactions with each other. And it takes Sterling K. Brown's Cliff's sort of conversations with him later on that sort of not necessarily humanize him, but add to that perspective and fullness of the Monk character
mm-hmm.
that Jeffrey Wright is so good at sort of portraying.
Yeah. Yeah. I think
so he's my best. Worst part of the movie, I thought the tonal shifts were a lot. I don't think that they made the movie bad, but jumping from the absurdist kind of book plot into the Alzheimer's, into the sort of meet cute relationship, back into the movie production, it's just there's a lot going on here.
Yeah.
And I understand that it's supposed to sort of lampoon the idea that there's these stereotypical things going on in the publishing space, and they're focusing on these things that are sort of like, you know, bombastic and like the most extreme aspects. Meanwhile, you know, Monk is dealing with these things that are very human and very down to earth and things that everyone deals with.
Mm-hmm.
I think that it was just a lot like of whiplash back and forth.
Mm-hmm.
And it didn't always work for me, and it did at times, but not always.
Yeah. And that's like, I agree with you on that. And I think that that's, for me, that's okay because that was a very clear choice by the filmmaker.
You asked me what my least, I don't think it was unsuccessful.
Yeah, exactly. I agree. I think my favorite stuff, definitely Jeffrey Wright, but the performances overall, I think were just really great. And I also, my favorite thing about this movie is this idea that so much is just ambiguous. And there's
in life.
Sometimes there's just no right answer. Sometimes there's just no clear ending that makes sense. Sometimes there's just the, you know, absurdities of life. And I like that.
Well, the thing that I love too, to add to that, is like when he breaks up, when, you know, Monk and Coraline break up, and he texts her and he's like, you know, I want to apologize. I want you to come with me to the dinner. You see her like text bubble pop up, and then she never sends anything, and then she doesn't come to the dinner with him, as far as, you know, he tells Wiley, like, we haven't talked
right.
since. So right. I love that. I love that it's like, you know, we're expected to read these, I guess, black stories in this context where everything is kind of like wrapped up, and it's always bad and negative and you know, sort of like negative essentially. And here, while it is something that is, you know, Monk doesn't want necessarily, it's not something that is, it's just something that isn't wrapped up, and it's something that is not, doesn't involve pain, really. Mm-hmm. It doesn't involve anything like that. It's like, there's negative feelings associated with it, but, I mean, we're looking at it from Monk's perspective, too. Like, from Coraline's perspective, I'm going to ask about this later, it might not be something so negative.
Right.
We don't really know her side of the relationship.
Yeah, right.
But I just think that I liked that little leaving that thread open
mm-hmm.
because it is just going to show that like there are lives, like life is not wrapped up like a movie or a book.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. So that's probably my favorite stuff. And then my least favorite. Yeah. The tonal shifts are a little like, woo, like heavy duty. And I just wish I knew more about, some of the characters. Like I wanted a little more about Sterling K. Brown's character, Cliff. I wanted a little more with Coraline, right? And so just, you know, but I don't want a longer movie, so I guess it, you know, I like the movie. I thought it wasn't too much to complain about there.
I thought that they were really efficient with the Cliff stuff.
Yeah, that is true. There's a lot packed into his scenes.
Which, again, also...
And scenes about that he's not in, but he's mentioned.
Are either about him or... And they all reflect on the dad, who you don't see in the movie at all, because he had already died by suicide prior to the movie. Mm-hmm. I don't think they really say how long ago, but it was like a while ago.
Mm-hmm.
And you can sort of see the remnants of that. And I think that Sterling K. Brown, Cliff, like, really is the sort of avatar of that.
Yeah.
In that whenever he's around, that's when that stuff gets brought up for the most part.
Right.
And so I think that, you know, with a lesser actor, you might not have gotten as much meat in that, like, in how little he was in the movie. He was in the movie less than I thought he was going to be,
mm-hmm.
Yeah. Knowing that he was nominated for supporting actor.
Right. Something else, one scene that I thought was really interesting was when the mom is talking to Monk about how, like, her husband was a genius and couldn't interact with people and connect. And Monk this whole time is thinking, like,
that it's him.
Oh, it's me that is also experiencing that. And she's like, it's the same with you, Cliffy. And then right. So she thinks she's talking to Cliff, obviously.
Yeah.
And so that kind of is an interesting, like, reveal, because Monk doesn't really, there's nothing to be done about it, right? Like, clearly he thought that she was talking about him. She's talking about her, you know, his brother. But what does that even mean, you know? Yeah.
And you don't really get much from Cliff in terms of, like, if we're talking about, like, a creative genius. Because I know he's, like, a plastic surgeon. So, I mean, he's a really, really smart and intelligent dude to be able to have gone through medical school and all that. So he's extremely smart. But we don't really get... It's kind of ambiguous as to what she's talking about.
Right.
You know?
And I like that, because we don't need to be privy to all that information.
Yeah. It's just a family that is privy to the information.
It's interesting. Really, really well written there, I thought. Well, let's talk about how Jeffrey Wright and Sterling K. Brown's performances stack up with their competitors at the Oscars. So we've seen some, not all.
We haven't seen Poor Things, right?
We haven't seen Poor Things, so we haven't seen the Mark Ruffalo supporting actor performance. But let's talk about, you want to start with supporting?
Yeah.
So supporting, it's Mark Ruffalo, which we, again, have not seen yet, and I heard he's great.
Withholding judgment on that one.
Yeah. So it's Sterling K.
Brown. He also had, I mean, in all honesty, has no chance of winning, so.
No. Sterling K. Brown, Ryan Gosling, Robert Downey Jr., and Robert De Niro.
Yes.
We've seen those four performances.
We have.
How does Sterling K. Brown's performance and maybe just role stack up to the others, in your opinion?
I think if we're talking his fit in the movie in terms of how well Sterling K. Brown portrayed Cliff in a way that was in service of the movie.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I got him over Downey.
Yeah.
It's tough. Gosling and De Niro are both amazing.
Really,
this
really
year.
Good. I know.
I would put him in that conversation, but I would probably put him third.
Yeah, I think I agree. What I do like is that his character truly feels like a supporting role.
Yes.
And I think that it's in real true in spirit of what that award is.
Absolutely.
Which is a supporting role. Like, Ken, you could consider the male lead.
Mm-hmm.
I know that he's not. He really is a supporting role in it, but he's a huge role in Barbie. Same with
De Niro. Same, yeah.
He is, like, really, truly, like, he's in a lot of it. He's the force behind everything. And with American Fiction, just like with Robert De Niro or Robert Downey Jr.'s role, it's a supporting role. This is Monk's story in American Fiction. And of course, Cliff is important to it, but it's not equal thing, or it's not like even just like a one step down. Like, he's very much a supporting role. And I think that even though he's a supporting role, Sterling K. Brown's performance helped it, like, really permeate through the story.
Yeah.
And so I really loved his, I think he's very deserving.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that some of the other people that maybe got knocked off because of it, I think that both of the other ones could have been lead roles. Like, I'm thinking Charles Melton
in May December
and Dominic Sessa in The Holdovers. They both kind of are lead adjacent to me, while I find that this Sterling K. Brown's role fits in with the category really well.
Well, yeah, because Sessa's in the entire movie and Melton's in most of the movie.
Exactly. So I think it's a well-deserved nomination. I think I would still put it third, just because I really think that, like, it might be one of my favorite De Niro performances ever. Same. And like Gosling, it's an icon. It'll be seen as an iconic role for a really long time. But I would definitely put it above Downey Jr.
Yeah. And well, the one thing I'll push back on about Downey is I felt that he was as large a part of the movie, not necessarily as Cillian Murphy was, but he was like almost the narrator at parts of it. He was part of the exposition is through him and what's his name talking back and forth with each other.
Yeah.
His like aide or whatever.
Well, maybe it's just that the movie was 17 hours long that I was like, oh, he's not in it that
much. He's barely in this. And it's like, yeah, he was in it for 2 hours. Yeah, no. I think I would put Sterling K. Brown third, but it's an excellent, excellent role. And I think it's a pretty good year for supporting actor.
I agree. What about for actor?
So we've seen Maestro.
Yeah.
We've seen half of Rustin.
Yeah. Enough that we get the gist.
Yeah. We've seen The Holdovers and we've seen Oppenheimer.
Yeah.
This is a tough one. Again, I think he might be...
Third, right in the middle?
Jeffrey Wright might be third.
Yeah.
Maybe above Giamatti.
Oh.
So I think that my order from 5 to 1 would be Bradley Cooper 5.
Oof.
Colman Domingo 4.
Yeah.
I'm going to say it. Paul Giamatti 3. And wow. I love Giamatti in The Holdovers. Jeffrey Wright 2 and Cillian Murphy 1.
Why are you putting Jeffrey Wright 2nd?
I think this is the role of Cillian Murphy's career, first of all.
Yeah.
I thought he was excellent. I think people are getting a little bit of Oppenheimer fatigue and are kind of like, whatever. You know, he was good, but whatever. I don't know. I remember just being blown away by it. As for the people behind Jeffrey Wright, I don't want to bash Maestro too much. I just didn't enjoy it.
Yeah, not your thing.
Colman Domingo, I think, is good in Rustin, but it's not really his fault, but I don't feel that the movie's doing anything that we have.
It's it's typical biopic.
It's a story that I didn't know, and I'm glad to learn about it.
Mm-hmm.
But
it's not presented
structure-wise,
in an
interesting way. Writing-wise. Yeah, right. It's not incredibly interesting in the way that it's presented. Which isn't necessarily his fault, but it makes his performance a little like cartoony almost. But I do think he's really good. I'm sure that I don't know who Bayard Rustin. I'm not super familiar with him. Mm-hmm. I should be clearly, but I don't know what he was like in real life. So it's hard for
you
me
can't
to
compare it to.
Yeah.
Right.
I'm also kind of, I mean, this is kind of stupid of me to say while putting Cillian Murphy first, but I'm kind of over like actors winning for playing people.
Mm-hmm.
But again, I'm not really comparing him to J. Robert Oppenheimer because I don't know. But I'm just going with the Murphy performance.
Right.
But I do love Giamatti in The Holdovers. As you would know, if you listen to our Holdovers episode, he's the best. He's neurotic. He's Giamatti. It's everything Giamatti, like all packed up into one.
Mm-hmm.
But Jeffrey Wright, to me, I think what puts him over the top is like, it's honestly something similar to Giamatti in that, like I said before, it's a guy who you shouldn't like.
Mm-hmm.
This guy should be so annoying. Like, you know, Paul in The Holdovers, but there's something about those two actors, and I find them to be similar actors in terms of like the way that they're situated and the types of characters that they are good at playing.
Mm-hmm.
It's just, I don't know, maybe it's that I saw American Fiction more recently,
yeah.
But I would put them like right on the same level, and
yeah,
like
I agree.
Maybe like a half step under Cillian Murphy.
Fair, all right, not bad. All right, so spoilers, spoilers, spoilers. In this movie, which you already know because you listened to the plot summary, Tracy Ellis Ross's character, who plays Jeffrey Wright's sister, she dies like really quickly into the movie. Like she's in a couple scenes and you think she's going to be a much bigger part. You see a really interesting relationship between the two of them and... she just dies.
She does.
Like, really, just like, oh, okay. So, I found that shocking. Like, I was really surprised when that happened.
Well, we saw her, like, when it was the hospital scene, and he's, like, looking into the hospital ladder. I was like, are you serious?
Yeah, like, it's really crazy.
But it also wasn't surprising only because I didn't know that she was even, like, in the movie. Because there's no marketing surrounding her. So,
right.
I was like... when that was happening, I was like,
But she's listed as the second.
She is.
When they are at the beginning, when they have the character,
she
or
is.
The actors.
It's only shocking because I'm paying attention to the award season.
Yeah.
If I wasn't paying attention to award season, I would have had no idea.
Right. So I was wondering, are there any deaths in movies that are either super earlier than you thought they would be or crazy? I mean, the classics are Your Psycho.
Wait. I want to give the movie title, then give like 2 seconds or a second of silence, and then we can, so you can skip it if you want.
Psycho from 1960. Crane, the character.
You've only had 64 years to watch Psycho.
And Scream, of course.
Which is an homage to Psycho.
Which is an homage to Psycho with Drew Barrymore's character, Casey, becoming a victim very early. I have a couple if you're interested.
Yeah, go for it.
One we watched pretty recently, The Departed. Leonardo DiCaprio's character. He dies.
Just shocking in general that he dies.
Yeah, right, exactly. Well,
everyone dies in The Departed.
True.
Except for one man.
Yes, that is true. Another one, we watched this on a bus. Burn After Reading. Remember when Chad died? Brad Pitt's character.
Yes. Oh my God. He's like, that movie, I didn't love it. But when I think about that movie, I just crack up.
He was great.
Because Tilda Swinton was great in that movie. Everybody was great in that movie. It just didn't like land for me for some reason.
Yeah. And then how about Kingsman? With Colin Firth.
Yeah.
That was like, oh, wow, that really actually, that crazy scene with Freebird playing in the background.
Yeah.
Right? That was kind of
I just always think about the church scene.
That's the scene.
That's the scene that I always think of when I think about
so
that
good.
Movie.
And then finally, these are all from a BuzzFeed list that I thought were pretty spot on. Tommy Boy's dad.
Yeah. What did they call him? What was his name? What was their last name?
Callahan.
Didn't they just call him Cal?
Maybe.
Big Cal or something?
See, there you go. So those are probably mine. Do you have any others?
Well, I've got a couple. I took it as like characters who died like early. Mm-hmm. Like a Psycho type thing where it's like, oh, they're listed high in the cast and then they die like kind of randomly out of nowhere.
Yeah.
I'm going to start with a really random one that I just saw on a list too, but I remember watching it being like, wow. The Place Beyond the Pines.
Oh yeah, Ryan Gosling.
Yeah, who dies like halfway through, yeah. But he's like the lead.
Yeah.
It's like him and Bradley Cooper are like kind of both the lead.
Yeah. That movie was not very good.
No, but I do remember that.
I remember it.
We have an iconic one, Sunset Boulevard.
Oh, okay, yeah.
So William Holden it's about like him investigating, like we knew that there was a murder. But like the opening scene is him and then you see his body like floating in the swimming pool. Yeah. And then the movie's about how it got there.
Oh, how about Woody Harrelson in Three Billboards?
Yeah.
That was crazy.
Yeah. Star Wars has an Obi-Wan Kenobi one.
Okay.
In the first Star Wars. Yeah, you got Departed, you got Scream, you got Psycho. There was another one that I saw that I'm looking for. Here. Oh, what about Gravity?
Oh yeah, George Clooney.
Clooney, when it's like, okay, well now Sandra Bullock's just in space
by herself.
Oh, and this one we talked about a long time ago. This is not one that I've seen, but it makes me crack up. G.I. Joe Retaliation, when Channing Tatum dies early on.
Yeah, because he's like, I don't want to be in this movie.
He was under contract and he hated filming the first one. And I think there was something, maybe it was 21 Jump Street. That like he kind of blew up in between there, and he was like, "I don't want to do this movie."
He had a little leverage, yeah.
Yeah, and he had to fulfill his contract, so they killed him off in like the first scene.
That's kind of iconic.
Yeah, but yeah, there's a bunch of great ones. I mean, obviously, you start Citizen Kane off with with Kane himself dying.
Yeah.
Hereditary.
I don't want to.
Hereditary,
this
man.
Scary.
The marketing. Of it being about the girl.
Yeah.
And then.
That is smart.
She goes on a drive with her brother.
Yeah, I didn't watch that movie. I watched Lilo and Stitch instead.
You did watch Lilo and Stitch while I was watching that. But yeah, no, I think that's a modern example.
Bambi's mom.
Yeah, Mufasa.
Mufasa, that was crazy.
Yeah, but I think Hereditary is like the modern example of this.
Yeah, sure.
Something that is like this. But I think this one's right up there. I was really surprised.
I really was.
Tracy Ellis Ross died in this movie.
Yeah. So those are all the questions that I have.
Okay. I'm going to do one about the movie and then one not specifically about the movie. So my first one is, if you were Coraline, would you go back with Monk? And what would your, like, I guess sort of the same question, like what would your reaction be? Assuming he's going to tell her that he wrote the book.
Well, that's the problem. I feel like, yes, I would. Because, like, okay, you got into a fight over, like, liking a book and he was weird about it, whatever. Like, people fight. That's fine. But then, after that, if I then found out that he wrote the book
and wrote it almost out of like hatred for those for its subject matter.
And like it was all this big thing and he had not told you any of that. Nah, I don't think I'd be able to. So like originally I'd be like, oh yeah, I'll go to the dinner with you. I'll do whatever. But then I don't think I could handle the reveal. What about you?
I don't know. It's hard to say. I mean,
they were getting along really well.
Yeah, and it's not really said how long their relationship. It wasn't very long though. It wasn't like
not like years and years.
I was thinking like probably like a couple months.
Yeah,
and I just don't know if it's all worth it. You know,
Monk is annoying.
She likes him. She's read his other books and she's liked his other books. And she like specifically sought out his books. She knew who he was when she saw him, mm-hmm. which was rare for him. You know, he went into, I love the Barnes & Noble scene was so good.
Yeah.
When he went into Barnes & Noble and he found his books in the African-American studies section.
Yes.
And he was like, these aren't African-American studies. And he's yelling at, I forget the kid's name. The worker's name, the white guy, the white kid's name. But he like grabs all the books and he like brings them over to like a different section. And it's just such a, it's not comedic because he's upset about it, but it plays for comedy.
Right.
And so, like, she knows who he is, and that's meaningful to him.
Mm-hmm.
And but I don't know if there's anything here from her perspective that he's, like, done for her.
Right.
Like, it's more about, it's everything's always about him.
Right.
So, he would have to come back and be like, listen, I know I messed up. I know this is crazy. This is a wild situation. I know that, like, this guy's supposed to be a fugitive, but it's actually me.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote this stuff because I hate this stuff and I wrote it as a joke and I didn't want it to get, and then like this whole big story, and I would just be like, what? It would have to be like a really big, like, can we please start over kind of thing.
Right, right.
Like, we're not just picking up where we left off. Like, we need to establish everything again.
Right. Yeah.
That would be the only chance, but I don't know, man.
Poor Monk.
But that's the thing, because like Jeffrey Wright's so good that like, you know, Monk's a good guy.
Is he?
I think he is.
I think so, too.
I think he is because his siblings, like, really do empathize with him.
And I think he's stepping up to the plate with his mom. And
Lorraine loves him.
Yeah, and he's clearly had it rough, like, with his dad. And just, like, he's in this kind of crisis moment in his career.
Yeah, and he's buried himself in, like, color blindness, per se. And mm-hmm. it's not working for him because he just built up these defense mechanisms and... Mm-hmm. Nobody really likes being around him. He got kicked out of school, his teaching being a professor. Like he's going through it, right. And you know, that's where he's at.
Yeah.
I think he's a good guy.
Poor Monk.
Okay, and now my final question. All right, so I'm going to have to do a disclaimer here, but I'll ask the question first. What are your favorite kind of character actor turned lead actor movies? So Jeffrey Wright, as we talked about, is not necessarily just a character actor. He had, you know, Basquiat a long, long time ago. He was a lead in that. It's not like this is his first lead role. But mm-hmm. I feel like the general consensus among people who, especially who have gotten to know him more since, like, Westworld, which was, like, one of the things that kind of got him big among people, like, of my people that I know,
mm-hmm.
He's known generally as a character actor.
Yeah.
What are your favorite types of those movies where you get somebody who finally gets like a really nice spotlight? Well, and another thing, I feel like if you ask Jeffrey Wright, I bet he feels like he's a better actor now than he was when he did Basquiat.
I mean, most people probably think that, right? Years later.
They're two separate stages of his career too. Right. So that's something to be said about that too. But what are your favorite of those like types of movies?
So I think that like it's hard now because he's been the lead in so many different things now, but there was a time where Bill Murray was like just doing kind of supporting stuff, and then I feel like Lost in Translation kind of brought him back to that kind of like leading man role, which is kind of weird. And I thought that was an interesting one, and it's a really interesting movie.
I haven't seen it.
Yeah, but it's
Sofia Coppola, right?
Yeah,
I know it's like problematic different. Now, but
oh, is it?
I think so.
Never mind, skip that one. I haven't seen it for a really long time.
I think it's just like the age difference, and
oh yeah,
Scarlett Johansson wasn't like super comfortable filming the movie. I think it's like stuff like that.
But since then, we've seen him be the lead in a lot of different movies, which is kind of an interesting like. Oh, now he's just like a starring.
It's a Bill Murray movie.
Yeah, which is an interesting thing.
Like it was when he did like Scrooged in the 80s.
Exactly. What about Bob?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
I think seeing something like Vera Drake.
Imelda Staunton.
Yeah, Imelda Staunton, who
Professor Umbridge.
People know as like Professor Umbridge. Seeing her in a leading role makes you go like, oh wow, she's like really good.
She was in Pride also, right?
She was in Pride. She had a small role in Pride, yeah, which was another great movie. And yeah, so I think seeing her in Vera Drake was awesome. You got to give a shout out to Mr. Turner.
Oh man. Timothy Spall.
Yeah, Timothy Spall.
Wormtail. We're just working through the Harry Potter cast.
Yeah, think of anybody from the Harry Potter cast getting like a major lead role in something. Yeah.
Other than the Dumbledores, because like Gambon was a leading man, Richard Harris was a leading man for a while.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I think that those are really good ones. I think the Brits kind of will do that every now and then where they'll Judi Dench, when she did Philomena a couple years ago, I was like, wow.
That was like really, 10 years ago.
Oh, God. that, like, she really lit the screen on fire in that one. Not even being sarcastic. Like, that was a really good movie.
Was that that was Steve Coogan, right? That was the guy in the movie?
And that actually reminds me of Stan and Ollie, where you have Steve Coogan and John C. Reilly.
Yeah.
Two really good actors that could probably be seen more as character actors in co-leading roles, and I thought that was a really good movie as well. It's hard because sometimes you have to seek out these like smaller movies,
yeah,
to get those character actors getting a shot at a lead role, but oftentimes that's where I find the best performances that I find I'm really drawn to.
Well, because part of what makes a great character actor is being able to evoke emotion and being able to pack a lot of sort of depth into a small part, into a very small role. So a lot of times when you get somebody who is so good at doing that, and then you give them 90 minutes, 2 hours to sort of be the lead in a movie, you get a fully fleshed out version of that.
Right.
So a lot of times it can be really successful.
What other ones did you think of?
So the first one that came to mind was Paris, Texas.
Yeah.
Because Harry Dean Stanton, one of the more prolific character actors going back to the 50s. I mean,
he's the dad in Pretty in Pink. That's what I knew him from.
He's got Godfather 2. He's got Cool Hand Luke. He's got Alien, Escape from New York, Christine. Then he did Paris, Texas in 84, where he plays the lead. And he's basically a guy who is trying to help his son find his estranged ex-wife.
Yeah, it's an interesting movie.
It's a thoughtful movie. But then he goes back to Pretty in Pink. He's a smaller role in Last Temptation of Christ. Then he does some David Lynch stuff. He does Wild at Heart, the Twin Peaks movie, Green Mile, The Straight Story, another Twin Peaks movie. Twin Peaks, another David Lynch movie. He was in The Avengers 2012. So, mm-hmm. He just does all these, like, you know, if not minor parts, then, like, recurring, supporting parts. Mm-hmm. But he got his time to shine in Paris, Texas. And the movie's slow. The movie's not for everybody, but I thought he was excellent.
Mm-hmm.
What else we got here? Does Philip Seymour Hoffman count?
I don't know.
He's again, I feel like somebody people associate with as a character actor.
Yeah.
Because you got Capote, which he literally won. He won the award for that, right?
Yeah.
He won best actor, best lead actor for Capote. So maybe he doesn't count, but whatever. Synecdoche, New York is another one where he's just, again, you may or may not like Charlie Kaufman movies, but I don't know if there's a better muse for Charlie Kaufman than Philip Seymour Hoffman.
It's true.
He's just got some great stuff. And he's great in everything you see him in.
Everything.
He's great in Doubt. He's great in The Big Lebowski. He's great.
Along Came Polly.
You know, I didn't see the Hunger Games movies, but like...
He's fine. The Hunger Games isn't exactly going to be a
but I'm just saying,
acting spectacle for everybody.
But I'm just saying, like, people that have seen him, that know him from that are like, you know, I don't know anybody who is like, eh, I'm not really...
No, everybody's
really,
a...
I don't really like Philip Seymour Hoffman.
Everybody likes him.
And you think of like The Master, too.
Everybody likes Philip Seymour Hoffman.
He's just done so much different stuff.
And he's awesome.
And his lead roles are no worse. Another one. Does Paul Giamatti count?
Yeah. What else is he big in? John Adams and Big Fat Liar?
Billions?
Yeah. He's a character actor.
He was lead in Sideways. He was the lead in Holdovers.
He's my king.
He has the... We're going vibes here. We go on vibes here. Paul Giamatti has the vibe of a character actor.
Yeah.
Even though he's technically been the lead in quite a few things. Holdovers, like I said, Sideways. I didn't watch Billions, so I can't give him that. But that's a whole show of like 55 seasons where I think he's the lead.
I don't know.
Based on the marketing, he seems like he's the lead.
when you got PG, you gotta put them front and center.
Exactly. Like they did in Big Fat Liar.
That's right.
You got to make them as blue as possible.
Yep.
Tilda Swinton.
Yeah, yeah.
She's kind of in the side of everything, but then she was in We Need to Talk About Kevin
as
the mom.
Yeah, she was really good in that.
And she was excellent in that. And she was in a movie called Memoria, which is a really freaking weird movie.
Yeah.
And she's another one, like, she's always adds something to the movie, whether it's, was it Snowpiercer she was in?
Yes.
Okja, too.
Yep.
She was in Burn After Reading, which we just talked about.
Mm-hmm.
She's been in Doctor Strange. She's been in, like, so much, like, random stuff. Mm-hmm. And she's always a unique character. And then you put her in We Need to Talk About Kevin, and she's just the mom of a kid mm-hmm. who's a troubled kid, mm-hmm. who's a troubled person in real life.
Yeah.
And, like, she just knocks it out of the park because she's so good at drawing that in such a, you know, intense way.
Mm-hmm.
Does Cillian Murphy count?
I don't
know. Is Oppenheimer this type of movie?
I don't know.
Because I know he's been the lead in some things before, but...
I think he's a lead actor. I don't think... Because I think even like 28 Days, whatever.
Is he the lead in... I don't know. I haven't seen it.
Yeah, I think so. I don't know. He's in that... he's in the big scene.
Was he in Sunshine also? The other Danny Boyle movie?
Well, I don't know.
I think he... Let's look it up. Cillian Murphy lead roles. Because I feel like this was his like breakout role. Because I guess he was the lead in Peaky Blinders. That does make sense. Yeah, no. I'm going to go no on Cillian Murphy here. I just literally wrote down, does Cillian Murphy count? My last one is not really in movies because I haven't seen the one movie where this happened with him, but Bob Odenkirk.
Mm, yeah.
Going from sort of the funny guy, mm-hmm. You know, the what's the show with him and David Cross? I forget the name of it. Mr. Show with Bob and David, I think.
Yeah.
The sketch show. And then, you know, obviously into Breaking Bad. Then getting his Breaking Bad spinoff and being the lead in that and being, in my opinion, Better Call Saul is better than Breaking Bad.
Hot take.
I think it's getting less hot the more time goes on. But I didn't see Nobody, mm-hmm. which is the one so far that he like was the actual lead in. And mm-hmm. it was like billed as like Better Call Saul's Taken.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, he's another one where, you know, you give him more time and he's... I was extremely skeptical of Better Call Saul, being like, this guy's a joke in Breaking Bad. He's not a character I needed to know more about, I didn't think. And then the way that they put, you know, that movie, that series together, and, you know, just totally, totally genius.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so those are a few of my faves.
There you go.
My notes. Oh, Adam Brody played another great idiot.
Yeah, he's good at that.
He's really good at playing.
He's been able to make a little niche for himself with like supporting roles in a few different movies.
He did that lately. In Promising Young Woman.
I loved him in The OC back when I was in high school, so it's cool to see him get some roles like that.
You know who he reminded me of in this movie, who I think also would have been good in this role?
Who?
Ben Schwartz.
Yeah, definitely.
It was a very like a John Ralphio type role.
Definitely.
And that's it. The only other note that I have that we didn't talk about was Leslie Huggams' rules.
She was awesome.
I'll do trivia. I don't think I got five. I got four. Tom's top four trivia. So according to an interview in the Arizona Daily Star, most of the fictional book titles of the literary award finalists, all the other books, were the names of bands who Cord Jefferson was friends with during middle school and high school in Tucson.
There you go.
The photo that Monk stares at in the stairway when he's like texting Coraline mm-hmm. and he's going into the thing is from Doctors Kenneth and Mamie Clark's study, The Doll Test, which was used in the Supreme Court case Brown versus Board of Education.
Mm.
Number three, I don't know how true this is. Again, I got it from IMDb. I could see it being true, but maybe not. First Best Picture nominee to include the term Oscar bait in the film.
Oh, that's funny.
And number four, the family name Ellison is based on several influential writers, each influencing aspects of Monk and the story.
Ralph Ellison.
Ralph Ellison wrote Invisible Man about social and intellectual issues faced by African Americans. Harlan Ellison wrote speculative fiction and was known for his abrasive attitude. And Sheila Ellison is a writer and speaker who discusses issues regarding parenting and relationships.
Interesting.
Yeah. I like little things like that where you get character names that are really meaningful and add to the
mm-hmm.
interpretation of the character. Yeah, so not a ton of trivia because the movie's so brand new. But I do have a little bit of a deep dive, and I'll add the link in the show notes. So with the deep dive, it's either something that we go into that we found really interesting or some article or video or something that I found that I wanted to give a little bit of a shout out to. And this one is, I actually, of course, did not get the name of the article, but it's an Esquire interview with Cord Jefferson. It's called Cord Jefferson Wants You to Argue About American Fiction. And the little bit that I'm going to quote here is he's talking about they asked him why. So the scene where Monk is writing My Pathology, sort of, I guess, like what the book does, it has two actors enacting one of the scenes as he's writing it. And like you see him in the background and he's kind of thinking and he's typing. And then you see the two actors sort of acting it out with each other.
Mm-hmm.
And it's Keith David, who is like one of the character actors.
Yes.
And I got I wrote down how to write his name. It's Okediate Onadawan.
Mm-hmm. From Hamilton.
And they played the father and son in My Pathology.
Mm-hmm.
And the question is about, they ask him, one of my favorite scenes in the movie depicts Monk writing in his office. His characters appear to him performing the scene he's writing in front of his very eyes. How did you decide to depict the creative act like this? And he just says, this was also one of my favorite scenes in the movie.
So good.
He said, I knew that I needed to depict this in a way that made the audience lean forward. We've all seen that scene of the writer pounding the keyboard frantically, then taking a big sip of coffee and getting back to it. That's how you depict somebody intensely writing. But I thought, we can't have that. It's tropey and silly, and it doesn't get the audience's minds going. So why not have these characters manifest in front of him? When I wrote that scene, I wrote the language to be very silly. It had to be ridiculous so that everybody could see how stupid this book is and what a sham it is. Then we got Keith David and Okiyote Odonowon, who are both tremendous actors. All of a sudden, it wasn't silly anymore. They made it seem like the book might be good.
Yeah, right.
I love what the scene became in their hands. Suddenly, you're questioning whether or not the book is good, which is evidence that something as ridiculous as this book could become a hit. And the thing I love about that description of that scene is it shows, again, how layered even the stupidest part of this movie is.
Mm-hmm.
And how also it goes to show how good of a writer Monk is.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's got all these books that are critically well-received that just don't sell. He's a great writer.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes he's just got to let loose and he can make a book that is going to sell.
Right.
He doesn't necessarily have to agree with what he's writing, and he doesn't.
Right.
But in the end, he does make money off of it. And he does, I guess, the implication is that he's going to use it to sort of help his mom and help his family. But I just love all the little complexities there.
Well, right. It goes again with that ambiguity of what's right and what's wrong, what's good and what's bad. It's not black and white.
And I think that scene and the way that he writes that scene and the way that it's shown on screen is a perfect encapsulation of what this movie is about.
Right. Well, and I also think it just shows like Monk's actually a good writer. Yeah. So he could bring maybe something good out of something that he disagrees with.
And he can make the stupidest thing
sound compelling. Better. Right.
Yeah. So that's the deep dive, and I'll throw that whole interview. It's a lot. It's more about a lot more than that in the show notes. And I think that's all I've got, because there's no Roger Ebert review, RIP. There were no taglines for this movie that I could find. So, yeah, I think that's it. Does American Fiction make Baby's First Watch List?
Yeah.
Yes. And also, we didn't do it for The Princess Bride last week, but it obviously...
That makes it too.
Yeah. yeah. So we don't know what we're going to do next week yet.
No.
We're still working on, we got norovirus.
Yes.
We're still working on March.
Yes.
I do know that we're going to have Uncle Nick P back on, of course, post-Oscars.
Yep.
We'll probably drop that on Wednesday instead of Tuesday, the 13th. But other than that, we're still working on it. We might do the Lindsay Lohan Irish Wish
Netflix movie
for St. Patrick's Day.
Yeah, probably. We probably will.
We did Falling for Christmas, so what's the difference?
So we got to do it.
We probably will do that. We might do a Mission Impossible we talked about. We might do... I don't know. Maybe we'll do another Best Picture or something like that.
Yeah.
We'll see.
Maybe a 70s movie.
Maybe a 70s movie, because I'm watching some 70s movies. We will obviously keep you posted on Instagram at Baby's First Watch List. So follow us there if you don't already. And we will see you next week for something.
All right.
See you later.
Bye.